for those of you who are not familiar with these type of broadcasts, one of the reasons we put the archive broadcast together was specifically so that people could tape them, all right? Because a lot of the things that we deal with are things that we touch on or deal with very briefly in the other broadcasts that we do, and we wind up covering these things a lot and going back over them. And a lot of the stuff that we're doing in the archive series are things that you could call the fundaments, the bottom level stuff that a lot of the other research and work is based on. So rather than always having to repeat these things, we decided to put this archive series together, and that is in fact what we're doing and what we're presenting tonight. So if you have a tape recorder around and some tapes, it is helpful to get this stuff recorded, and rather than, again, having to go back over it all the time, because there's so much stuff happening that we try and cover here at KFJC that we cannot spend as much time as we'd like to going back over things. Anyway, I'm going to let Dave tell you about some of the substance of what we covered in the last broadcast, which was incidentally about 8 weeks ago, so it has been quite a while, and I'm sure some of you will want bringing up to date.
Okay, now one of the things that we spent most of our time looking at in the first broadcast were some of the various techniques developed by the intelligence agencies and the military to effect mind control. Now, one of the things we looked at were a couple of techniques called RHIC and EDOM. RHIC stands for Radio Hypnotic Intracerebral Control. EDOM stands for Electronic Dissolution of Memory. Essentially, RHIC called for the implantation of a small electronic radio receiver, a stimulator which could stimulate a muscle upon receiving a signal. And what this did basically was to set off a hypno-programmed cue in the victim or subject, and this elicited a conditioned behavior. Now, electronic dissolution of memory called for the remote control production of acetylcholine, which basically blocked the transmission of nerve impulses in the brain and results in a sort of amnesia, and that wiped out the memory of the person who's been under or placed under mind control. Okay? Now, after that, we took a look at a number of different assassination programs that had been undertaken by the military or the intelligence community. We took a look at a technique or a program whereby assassins or would-be assassins were recruited by the Navy specifically, and they were then shown films to desensitize them to violence, and eventually were sort of assigned out as assassins, particularly operating out of American embassies abroad. And following that, we took a look at a fellow by the name of Castillo. Now, he, according to a number of, much of the information presented while he was being interviewed by the Philippine Security Service, that he not only had apparently been assigned to assassinate or attempt to assassinate Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, but he also, according to much of the information presented, was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy as well. Okay. Following that, we took a look at some information presented by a U.S. government assassin, which maintained that mind control had been affected by the police agencies and the FBI as well, that they basically had mind control programs underway. Another thing he pointed out was that ultrasound was often used for affecting mind control on assassins, okay? And we're going to be picking up at much the same place in this particular broadcast. We're going to be talking about assassinations, and specifically, we're going to begin talking about, talking about the possibility of mind control in connection with some of the figures involved in the assassination of President Kennedy, okay? First piece of information we're going to look at here comes from a book called Operation Mind Control. Operation Mind Control was authored by a man named Walter Bowert. It was published in softcover by Dell, copyrighted 1978. Now, the fellow we're talking about here is a guy by the name of George de Morenshield. Now, George de Morenshield, those of you who heard our series on the Guns of November about the assassination of President Kennedy, was basically Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitter. He sort of stewarded Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina around, introduced them to a number of different people, including the Paines, who ultimately got Lee Harvey Oswald his job at the Texas School Book Depository. They also, our George de Morenshield was also a German spy during World War II. He had connections to the Nobel Oil family of White Russia, and apparently his father managed the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family. Now, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was investigating George de Morenshield and his links to Lee Harvey Oswald, one of the things that they basically were checking out, well, while they were checking this out, George de Morenshield died of a shotgun blast to the head, and there are indications that that shotgun blast may have been self-administered and may have been the result of mind control. Now, when we were talking about Mr. Castillo last time, one of the things that, one of the disturbing types of behavior that Castillo demonstrated was that when his name was called, he basically pretended to, well, he acted, he would hold a phantom gun. Of course, he was under hypnosis. He didn't realize that it was a phantom gun and attempted to kill himself whenever his name was mentioned. Now, one of the focuses of the CIA and military mind control programs has been to get people to commit suicide on command when that was deemed necessary. Now, going back, reading from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert about George de Morenshield and the possibility that he was under mind control. In late March 1977, de Morenshield's name was brought before the newly formed House Select Committee on Assassinations. Willem Oltmans told the committee that de Morenshield held the key to the Kennedy assassination, that de Morenshield had privately confessed to him that prior to the assassination, he was aware of a conspiracy to murder the president in Dallas. According to Oltmans, de Morenshield was about to have a book published which would reveal the details of his knowledge of the assassination. After Oltmann's testimony, a spokesman for the House Committee on Assassinations said that the committee would investigate his claims and would, if warranted, track down de Morenshield for questioning. He was located a week later in Palm Beach, Florida, but he could not be called to testify. George de Morenshield was found dead, the victim of a gunshot wound in the head. Local officials termed his death a suicide. Following de Morenshield's death, his Dallas attorney, Pat Russell, supported Oltmann's claims to the commission. He verified the fact that before his death, de Morenshield had insisted that persons other than Lee Harvey Oswald had participated in the slaying of President Kennedy. The attorney revealed that he had in his possession tapes, a book-length manuscript, and a photograph which de Morenshield had turned over to him earlier. He said the tapes consisted of 10 reels of interviews with de Morenshield about the Kennedy assassination, which he claimed were first-hand accounts of the late professor's recollections of Oswald. Russell said that although he did not know if the tapes or the book contained any new evidence, the photograph should be of particular interest to assassination investigators. He claimed that although the photo was similar to a well-known picture obtained by the Dallas police which showed Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle and wearing a pistol, what made the photograph interesting was that it was autographed on the back by Oswald and dated May 4th, 1963, approximately 6 months prior to the assassination. After de Morenshield's death, Willem Oltmans, O-L-T-M-A-N-S, released a portion of his interview with the deceased. Oltmans described him as, quote, Oswald's most intimate friend, unquote, and without offering an explanation, said that he had been intimate with Oswald during, quote, the years when Oswald's brain was being programmed toward the murder of the century, unquote. And, of course, that refers to the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald was also under mind control, although it appears that he did not kill President Kennedy.
Okay, continuing on with Walter Bowert's book and the same section, it says, in the interview dated February 23, 1977, de Morenshield told Oltmans, quote, in June 1976, I completed a manuscript. That's when disaster struck. You see, in that book, I played the devil's advocate. Without directly implicating myself as an accomplice in the JFK assassination, I still mentioned a number of names, particularly of FBI and CIA officials who apparently may not be exposed under any circumstances. I was drugged surreptitiously. As a result, I was committed to a mental hospital. I was there 8 weeks and was given electric shocks and, as a consequence, I sometimes forget certain details temporarily. De Morenshield went on to say that as a result of the drugs and shocks, he could take no more. Quote, I tried to commit suicide 5 times. One of these days I will put a revolver to my head, unquote. According to Oltmans, de Morenshield left Dallas in the middle of the night on March 3, 1977, telling him, quote, I don't want anybody to see me. Oltmans reported that at the time de Morenshield was in a state of panic, constantly worried whether they would let him leave the country. Quote, he always felt watched and followed, Oltmans said. I really cannot see how somebody who does not have anything to hide would develop such behavior, unquote. On the day he died, George de Morenshield was being interviewed by author Edward J. Epstein for a book, The Legend of Lee Harvey Oswald. They broke for lunch at 1 o'clock, and Epstein walked de Morenshield to his car. They were supposed to resume the interview at 3 p.m., and, when de Morenshield didn't return, Epstein called his room and heard a distraught maid tell him that de Morenshield had taken his own life. De Morenshield's daughter, Alexandra, told Epstein that she believes her father took his own life after having had a post-hypnotic suggestion triggered by a voice over the telephone in his room. The last days of George de Morenschild sound strikingly similar to those of the victims of mind control. Could it have been that when drugs and electric shock failed to erase his memory, the final solution was prescribed? Or was he programmed to self-destruct? Okay, now, something that has to be pointed out, especially to those of you who are just tuning in for the first time. Allegations of somebody like George de Morenschild talking about having been in a mental hospital, having people follow him, trying to commit suicide 5 times and things like that. To people not familiar with the story of the Kennedy assassination, it may sound like, well, obviously this guy was a fringe case, you know, a loony, a psycho, and there's no surprise that a man like this would kill himself. Well, again, to people who are familiar with the Kennedy assassination, and for scraping the surface a little bit, I would recommend you back to the special that Dave and I did, The Guns of November. The Kennedy assassination and the people who tried to investigate it and the key witnesses in the Kennedy assassination have been dogged by this kind of thing all the way down the line. 20, 30, 40, 50 key people involved in the Kennedy assassination have met death in strange and odd ways. Many of them convinced that that they were in danger before they died, under odd circumstances and all kinds of things. And George de Morenschild himself was definitely a key player. He was not merely some fringe character wandering around claiming to know deep and secret things. He was somebody with an intelligence background who had been accused of being a Nazi spy, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's companion, and had many, many very strange and unusual things about his background and his, de Morenschild's, involvement with the intelligence complex. So this is not just somebody wandering in off the street. And, as those of you who have heard some of this Kennedy stuff and who perhaps heard the first broadcast know, again, these are the classic symptoms of something going on in terms of somebody being manipulated rather than merely a bunch of loonies walking on the street. A
couple of other points. First of all, George de Morenschild was not only fiercely anti-communist, he was a white Russian, recall. His father had worked for the Nobel family, who'd prospered under the Tsar, but he was a Nazi intelligence agent and basically an aristocrat. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald was an alleged leftist, allegedly with only an 8th-grade education, and this fits into the pattern that we saw in The Guns of November. Those of you who perhaps missed that show can contact us after the broadcast, and we can tell you how to pick up copies of it. That basically, alleged leftist and 8th-grade educated Lee Harvey Oswald seemed to roll around with fiercely anti-communist white Russians, Nazis, and high rollers in the aerospace industry, which is a strange set of bedfellows if ever there were or was. Anyway, another thing to take note of with George de Morenschild is the possibility, and this was suggested by his daughter Alexandra, that his suicide was committed by or triggered by a telephone cue. Now, this is a pattern that we're going to see later, in particular with a woman named Candy Jones. So try and remember this George de Morenschild telephone connection, because one of the things that was developed in mind control was the ability to trigger a hypno-programmed agent or patsy by using a telephone cue, and it's something we're going to run into a little later.
Okay. I think that, second of all, we're going to talk about a little bit about Robert F. Kennedy and the death of Robert F. Kennedy. Now, one of the key things here is that, and I know this for a fact because one of my own friends, a teacher, told me the other day, who's a man who himself does not believe the Warren Commission story of the John F. Kennedy assassination, this man has worked in Washington for Hubert Humphrey and has taught history for a number of years here in the area, has been to Russia. I mean, this man has gotten around. However, he said to me the other day, well, at least the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, that's one that I guess nobody can argue with. Well, as longtime listeners to this and other types of programming on KFJC are familiar, indeed, there's a lot to quibble with the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. In a nutshell, though, however, and one of the main reasons that people say this is because, as opposed to the John F. Kennedy assassination, everybody felt that the assassin had been seen in plain view, putting the bullets into the candidate, Senator Robert Kennedy, that killed him, and was immediately captured on the scene, and most people felt, well, that just about proves it. You can't pretend that there's somebody that nobody saw firing from a grassy knoll or blah, blah, blah. However, as the case turned out, and much of the Robert F. Kennedy's case, and much of the case against Sirhan Sirhan, was severely crippled, although it didn't keep him from being put in jail for it, by the coroner's own report. And the coroner himself was the first person to come up with a report, a forensic pathological report that basically refuted the early conclusions that Sirhan Sirhan had acted alone and had shot Robert Kennedy to death. Put briefly, it was because of what is called stapling. The bullet wound that killed Robert F. Kennedy was behind his right ear. It showed evidence of stapling, which are powder burns, and which cannot happen unless the gun is within 6 inches of the tissue being fired at, namely the back of his head.
And specifically, Coroner Thomas Noguchi, who, as a matter of fact, has a book out now called Coroner and is doing a promotional tour promoting that book, Coroner Noguchi testified that the fatal shot was fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Senator Kennedy's right ear, and since eyewitnesses in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel basically placed Sirhan anywhere from 3 to 11 feet in front of Senator Kennedy, it's problematic as to how he could have fired a shot from less than 1 inch from the back of his head when he was standing 3 to 11 feet in front of him. If you can figure that out, please let us know.
Indeed. There's a lot of discussion about witnesses not seeing things quite right the way that they happen, and divergence in testimony. Certainly there was divergence in the testimony of the witnesses. However, that was due to Sirhan thrashing around in the arms of the people who grabbed him as he was firing the shots. But not a single witness, and several placed him up as close as 3 or 4 feet, not a single witness of some 20 or 30 interviewed had him anywhere near enough to Robert F. Kennedy to fire that fatal shot.
The majority placed him about 7 or 8 feet in front of Senator Kennedy.
Now, some things came up later, which, again, we're not going to go into the whole Robert F. Kennedy assassination tonight, but among other things, there were bullet holes and bullet wounds to be accounted for to the number of about 10 bullets. Unfortunately, Sirhan Sirhan was only carrying a revolver that fired 8 bullets. One of the ways that this was dealt with by the Los Angeles Police Department and the Special Unit Senator Task Force in their inimitable way was to take all of the wood siding of the walls and the door frames that had bullet holes in it and take them out and burn them before the investigation was completed.
They also disposed of a sleeve from Robert Kennedy's jacket, which might have provided evidence as to the direction of the bullets. It's worth noting, Nip mentioned that the investigation of Robert Kennedy's assassination was conducted by a special unit of the Los Angeles Police Department called Special Unit Senator. Now, the two top operatives in Special Unit Senator just happened to be two Los Angeles policemen named Manny Pena and Enrique Hank Hernandez, and both of these men had not only worked for the LAPD, but they had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in Central and South America, and specifically had worked in conjunction with a man named Dan Mitrione in connection with the Office of Public Assistance. Well, basically, it was ostensibly to help the police forces of Latin America modernize. What Mitrione was really doing was teaching torture to various, specifically the Brazilian and Uruguayan governments in Latin America. And these two associates of his headed up Special Unit Senator. And it's worth noting, too, that the top suspect, the primary suspect of the person who really fired the shots was a man named Thane Eugene Caesar, who was working as a security guard in the Ambassador Hotel that night. He had formerly worked for Lockheed at its Burbank facility, which is closely affiliated with the U-2 project. And he had a gun, very much, in fact, the exact same kind of .22 caliber Ivor Johnson automatic that Sirhan fired, and lied about when he had gotten rid of it. It's also, there's a very famous picture of Robert Kennedy as he lies dying, and there's a young Chicano boy who's sort of cradling his head and looking up. If you look by Robert Kennedy's right hand, there's a clip-on tie which is lying on the floor by his right hand, and in many photographs of Thane Caesar, his clip-on tie is missing. And I believe it was a CBS, possibly an NBC reporter, did actually testify that a security guard was firing shots in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. So keep in mind Thane Eugene Caesar, because he's an interesting fellow, and last report he was coordinating Klan and Nazi Party activities down in Southern California. Anyway, that all is to give you an idea of just what actually happened with the Robert Kennedy assassination.
And it leads us to the supposition put forward by some people that if, in fact, the assassination was perpetrated, to use police language, from the rear by a real assassin, that Sirhan Sirhan was perhaps nothing more than a decoy. And that, in fact, if he was a decoy, that he was the best kind of decoy, which is a decoy that didn't realize what he was doing, perhaps because of some kind of hypnotic or drug programming.
And it's worth noting, too, that he has been portrayed as a lone nut with no political connections. Now, it's worth noting that the Saran family's entry into the United States was sponsored by a family who were very close friends and political allies of Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon, of course, won the presidency in 1968. Had Robert Kennedy not been assassinated, it would have been Robert Kennedy, since he had just wrapped up the Democratic nomination by winning the California primary. It would have been Robert Kennedy and not Hubert Horatio Humphrey, who went against Richard Nixon, and most observers agree that Senator Kennedy would have beaten Richard Nixon rather handily. Recall that Humphrey barely edged him out, and a little later we're going to talk about some other interesting people and organizations with whom Saran intersects. But keep in mind that his family's entry into the United States was sponsored by close friends and political allies of Richard Nixon.
All right. Now, in the early days of the, as a matter of fact, in the very first day of the investigation of the murder of Robert F. Kennedy, there was a particularly interesting discovery made, which was later used as basically being the final nail in the coffin of Sirhan Sirhan as far as his legal defense went. This, again, is from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert, and I'm going to read to you from that. On the floor next to Sirhan's bed was a large spiral notebook. On the desk was another notebook. There was a third small notebook, a good deal of occult literature, a brochure advertising a book on mental projection, and a large brown envelope from the Internal Revenue Service on which someone had written, "RFK must be disposed of like his brother was." At the bottom of the envelope was scrawled, "Reactionary." In one of the notebooks there was a page which was used later in the trial to prove premeditation. Quote, "May 18th. 9:45 a.m. 68. Of course, 1968 was the year in which Kennedy was killed. It was June 5th, so this was supposed to have been about 20 days before the assassination. "My determination," the notebook reads, "to eliminate RFK is becoming more the more of an unshakable obsession. RFK must die. RFK must be killed. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated." No punctuation between those. "Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated before 5 June 68. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. I have never heard. Please pay to the order of this or that. Please pay to the order of." Also drawn on the page were spirals, diamonds, and doodles.
Okay. The next passage here, now we're going to continue a little later in the Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert. We're going to tell you a little bit about someone named the Girl in the Polka Dot Dress and present you with some other anomalies about the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Okay, skipping along in Operation Mind Control. The chief counsel for the Los Angeles chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, A.L. Wirin, spelled W-I-R-I-N, went to Sirhan's defense within hours of his arrest. On his second meeting with the accused, Wirin brought the local papers with him. Sirhan read the headline, "Kennedy's Dead." Then he dropped his head in grief. After fighting to control his emotions, he looked at Wirin through tearful eyes and said, quote, "Mr. Wirin, I'm a failure. I believe in love, and instead of showing love..." Then Wirin recalled, quote, he muttered something about having betrayed his own primary beliefs. That night, Sirhan complained of being sick. He became very dizzy and had severe stomach cramps, just as Castillo and Candy Jones. By the way, just inserting here, Castillo we already talked about at the end of last show. Candy Jones is coming up. For several weeks, Sirhan was given a half grain of phenobarbital at night to help him sleep. The Los Angeles police went through the motions of looking into the possibility that a conspiracy was behind the RFK assassination. They looked for the girl in the polka dot dress, who witnesses said had been standing next to Sirhan, smiling and talking to him just before he began shooting in the pantry. Sirhan also said he'd been talking to the girl after he'd drunk several Tom Collinses. The girl in the polka dot dress was not found, and conflicting statements cast doubt on whether there had ever been such a girl. 45, quote, top men from the Los Angeles Police Department were assigned the job of tracking down all leads to a conspiracy, but incredibly, they came up empty-handed. A bag of women's clothing, which included a polka dot dress and new undergarments, was found by the LAPD in an alley, but police could not find out who'd brought them or who'd worn them. According to Sirhan's biographer, Robert Blair Kaiser, quote, the police and FBI hardly did all they could to find the owner of the polka dot dress. They used faulty logic and browbeat witnesses to eliminate the girl in the polka dot dress. To penetrate Ceron's amnesia, the defense decided to call in an expert hypnotist, Dr. Bernard L. Diamond of the University of California. Diamond was the associate dean of UCLA's School of Criminology and a professor of both law and psychiatry. No one knew more about law, psychiatry, and hypnosis than Diamond.
Now, before we tell you more here about Professor Diamond, remember that Ceron, who supposedly now had assassinated Robert Kennedy, appeared to be very grief-stricken and dumbfounded when informed that Robert Kennedy was dead. He also reacted in a very similar fashion not only to Mr. Castillo, possibly involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, as we looked at in the first broadcast, but also behaved in a fashion very similar to Candy Jones, a CIA mind-control courier who we're going to talk about later in the broadcast. Continuing now with Bernard Diamond, and the section of Walter Boward's book we're going to deal with now basically indicates that in all probability Bernard Diamond had hypnotized Ceron and under hypnosis convinced Ceron that he did in fact kill Senator Kennedy, whereas the physical evidence would indicate that he could not have killed Senator Kennedy, and his reaction upon learning of Senator Kennedy's death certainly indicates that he harbored no malice against RFK. Continuing now with Operation Mind Control. In a pre-hypnosis interview, Diamond asked Ceron to tell him about his notebooks, and Ceron said he couldn't recall writing them. Now recall, those are the same notebooks, the rambling, sort of stuttering notebooks that Niptuck read you about earlier in the book here. Diamond asked if he thought that what he had done helped things, and Ceron said, quote, "I'm not proud of what I did," unquote. "What do you mean you're not proud of it?" Diamond asked him. "You believe in your cause, don't you?" Ceron had been contacted by Arab sympathizers and others who insisted that the reason he'd killed Kennedy was out of sympathy for the PLO. "I have no exact knowledge, sir, that this happened yet. It's all in my mind, but goddammit, when my body played with it, I couldn't understand it. I still don't believe it. My body outsmarted my brain, I guess." "What did your body do?" Diamond asked. "Pulled that trigger," Ceron said. "Does your body remember it, even if your mind doesn't?" "I don't give a damn, sir, in a way. Now I don't even care," Ceron said. Diamond asked Ceron if he'd thought about suicide. "Hell no," Ceron said. "I couldn't do that." Then Diamond expressed a thought which contained a significant Freudian slip. "Why didn't you turn the gas on yourself? Why didn't you turn the gun on yourself after you killed Kennedy?" Recall, interrupting here, that many subjects of the CIA and military mind control programs had been trained to commit suicide, discussed in connection with DeMorenshield, as we're going to look at again in connection with Candy Jones, the courier mentioned earlier. Ceron waved his hand in front of his face. "It was all mixed up, like a dream," unquote. Diamond hypnotized Ceron on 6 of 8 visits. At one point, reliving the killing, Ceron grabbed at his belt on the left side. Until then, police had no idea where he'd carried the weapon. Under hypnosis, Ceron also created writings similar to those in his notebooks. In one session, Diamond had Ceron climb the bars of his cell like a monkey. After he'd been brought out of trance, Ceron explained the reason for his climb. He said he was only getting exercise. Then Diamond played the tape to prove to Ceron that he, Diamond, had given the instructions to Ceron to climb the cage, but Ceron denied that he'd done it because he'd been hypnotized. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Ceron's defense, testified that Ceron was a paranoid schizophrenic. Keep that in mind now. I'll read that last sentence again because this is central to the whole argument here. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Ceron's defense, testified that Ceron was a paranoid schizophrenic. His testimony was supported by several other doctors who had examined the psychiatric evidence obtained from tests, interviews, and hypno-interviews conducted by Diamond. Dr. Diamond did not consider that Ceron had been other than self-programmed. Having worked for the Army Medical Corps in World War II, he did not realize that the U.S. cryptocracy could develop mind control and use it to control the political destiny of the nation. Ceron was given yet another battery of tests by Dr. Eric Marcus, a court-appointed psychiatrist for the defense. Among the tests was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the MMPI, which contains more than 500 questions requiring true-false answers. Psychologists interpret the answers to the MMPI according to a set of statistical norms. Two of Ceron's non-responses were significant, since usually non-responses are considered to be more important than the yes-no responses. The questions Saran did not respond to were, number 291, at one or more times in my life, I felt that someone was making me do things by hypnotizing me. And 293, someone has been trying to influence my mind.
Okay. Continuing on a little further on in Walter Bauert's book, and again, after Sirhan has gone to trial, been convicted, and in the words of Walter Bauert, quickly put away for life, he goes on to talk about some of the experiences that Sirhan had with other hypnotists and hypnosis while in prison. And it says as follows, "There were those, however, who refused to let the matter rest. In 1973, while Sirhan sat in prison, Dr. Edward Simpson, the San Quentin prison psychiatrist, submitted an affidavit to the California courts requesting that Sirhan be granted a new trial and that the Robert Kennedy case be reopened. Dr. Simpson testified that the, quote, expert psychiatric psychological testimony at Sirhan's trial was full of numerous factual errors and misleading to the jury. Quote, most of the doctors testifying, Simpson said, saw their role as proving why Sirhan killed Kennedy, which required a focus on pathology, mental illness, that I found does not exist. They failed to consider the real facts in a more objective light, and failed to consider the possibility clearly suggested by the ballistic testimony and Sirhan's own testimony under close scrutiny that perhaps Sirhan did not kill Robert F. Kennedy. Sirhan's trial, Dr. Simpson wrote, was not handled properly by the mental health professionals. In retrospect, a close study of the trial testimony and my own extensive study of Sirhan leads to one irrevocable and obvious conclusion. Sirhan's trial was and will be remembered as the psychiatric blunder of the century. Dr. Simpson knew whereof he spoke. For 6 years he had worked at San Quentin Prison and had made a study of men on death row. For 2 years he'd been in charge of the prison psychological testing program. In 1969 he interviewed and tested Sirhan extensively during 20 weekly visits. After these visits were terminated, Sirhan requested that his family contact Simpson for the purpose of reviewing the psychiatric testimony that had been given at his trial. After examining Sirhan and reviewing the, quote, expert psychiatric testimony, Dr. Simpson discussed his findings with the prison's chief psychiatrist, Dr. David G. Schmidt. Together, they concluded that their findings did not confirm, quote, but in fact were strictly in conflict with the findings reported at Sirhan's trial. Quote, nowhere in Sirhan's test response, Dr. Simpson said in the affidavit, was I able to find evidence that he is a, quote, paranoid schizophrenic or, quote, psychotic, as testified by the doctors at the trial. The fact is, paranoid schizophrenics are almost impossible to hypnotize. They are too suspicious and do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives. They do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives, not to speak of a hypnotist from, for him, the most hated race. Psychotics in general are among the poorest subjects for hypnosis. They cannot concentrate, they do not follow instructions, and basically do not trust. Sirhan, however, was an unusually good hypnotic subject. Sirhan asked me to hypnotize him, which I did not do, in order not to contaminate my test findings with fantasies. He himself had manufactured a hypnodisc and was practicing self-hypnosis in his cell, an activity requiring considerable self-control, which no psychotic has. The fact that Sirhan was easy to hypnotize, as testified by Dr. Diamond, proves he was not a paranoid schizophrenic. Quote, Dr. Diamond, Simpson continued, used hypnosis in 6 sessions out of 8 with Sirhan. What was the purpose of it? To plant ideas in Sirhan's mind, ideas that were not there before? To make him accept the idea that he killed Robert F. Kennedy? When Dr. Diamond was unable to get Sirhan to admit that he wrote the notebooks, he testified, quote, so I undertook, this is, by the way, is Simpson talking about Dr. Diamond. He testified, quote, so I undertook some experiments on possible hypnotic suggestion, unquote. This admission, writes Simpson, strongly suggests the possibility of hypnosis being used for implanting hypothetical ideas in Sirhan's mind rather than uncovering facts. A lie detector, not hypnosis, should have been used in finding out whether Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. Now, before we continue on, let me just point out one factor here besides the obvious things being stated here, and that is Sirhan's own increasing interest in hypnotism. As we're going to see later in the broadcast when we get to talking about James Earl Ray and some other people, it's possible that this interest in hypnotism could be in and of itself evidence perhaps a lingering feeling, an undefinable feeling on the part of a hypnoprogram subject that something is wrong and that some kind of hypnosis is necessary to figure out what has been done. So again, this is just a possibility, but it does seem to crop up in other similar cases.
Going back to Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert, Saran, Dr. Diamond concluded, had obviously had experience with hypnosis before. He found that Saran was reluctant to speak under hypnosis, but that he could easily write without being post-hypnotically blocked. Writing under hypnosis is called automatic writing, Diamond said, and the term aptly describes the way Saran would write like a robot and keep on repeating a word or phrase until I stopped him, unquote. Taking a sheet off a legal pad lying nearby, Diamond asked Saran to write his answers to the questions put to him in the hypnotic trance. He showed Saran a sample of his diary page. Is this crazy writing? Diamond asked. Yes, 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 Saran wrote. Are you crazy? Diamond asked. No, no, Saran wrote. Well, why are you writing crazy? Diamond asked. Practice, 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 Saran responded. Practice for what? Diamond asked. Mind control, mind control, mind control, is what Saran wrote. Now remember, Diamond hypnotizes Saran, testifies that he's a paranoid schizophrenic, and yet provides contradictory testimony that he was easy to hypnotize. Paranoid schizophrenics are, for all intents and purposes, as in Dr. Simpson's testimony read earlier, impossible to hypnotize. So it appears that Dr. Diamond's analysis of Saran's situation is not only contradictory, but strongly suggests that, as indicated in Bowert's text, that Dr. Diamond was actually planting the idea in Saran's head that he had killed Robert Kennedy. It's worth noting that a lie detector is considered much, much more reliable than hypnosis, which frequently pollutes the results in a criminal investigation, and yet Diamond said he had no faith in a lie detector, but had a lot of faith in hypnosis. And while lie detectors are fallible, they're considered much, much more reliable than hypnosis. But again, remember that Diamond actually contradicted himself. Not only is there no evidence that Saran was a paranoid schizophrenic, but that Diamond's testimony that he was easy to hypnotize basically confirms that.
Okay, now, before Dave reads the next segment, I want to mention to you that this is out of a book that, if you are interested in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, and obviously we don't have much time to talk about it tonight, although we are touching on it quite a bit because of the aspect of mind control, this is quite a good book, and as far as I know, it's available in a lot of libraries. You might want to go out and check out a copy if you'd like to. It's a very affecting and moving book, and very interesting because it's written from by people who are actually involved in trying to track this stuff down, as opposed to somebody sitting back as a spectator. The book is The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and it's by John Christian, J-O-N-N, Christian, and William G. Turner.
And it's Bill Turner, by the way, is a former FBI agent, and it's published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1978. Now, one of the interesting things that Christian and Turner present here is the fact that Saran, that he, as indicated in Bowert's text, was very, very easy to hypnotize and had probably been hypnotized before. Now, one of the things that came out in the course of the investigation, although it did not receive a great deal of emphasis by a special unit senator for reasons you may be able to divine at this point, was the fact that Saran had been associated with a fellow by the name of Manly Palmer Hall. Now, Manly Palmer Hall was a master hypnotist. Interestingly enough, Manly Palmer Hall also served as not only a hypnotist, but a sort of a guru to Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty. Yorty was mayor of Los Angeles when Senator Kennedy was killed there in 1968. And it's worth noting, too, that Sam Yorty was one of the people who emerged the morning after the assassination, tossing red herrings all about him by suggesting that Saran was a communist and had many communist leanings, and then Yorty made a flaming rectum out of himself by referring to the Rosicrucians as a communist organization. But it's interesting that the same, or one of the same hypnotists that Saran was associated with, was also very, very close to Sam Yorty, a reactionary, a man tied to Patrick Frawley, a right-wing luminary, very close to Ronald Reagan, among others. And interesting that Saran and Yorty, who was so instrumental in presenting the, in pointing the finger at Saran as a communist early on in the investigation, much as Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged leftist, was bruited about as an agent of Marxism. Again, both of them, both Saran and Yorty, connected to Manly Palmer Hall. Reading from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Conveniently omitted was the fact that a police search of Saran's car yielded a volume entitled Healing, the Divine Art by Manly Palmer Hall, founder of the Philosophical Research Society. The book mysteriously disappeared from the grand jury exhibits. Hall, a man with penetrating eyes, chiseled features, and a Buddha-like figure, was a master hypnotist with a practice in hypnotherapy. Some time ago, he had gained considerable publicity from hypnotic antics, on one occasion putting under, unquote, a movie actor and convincing him he was suffocating, with the result that the actor tore apart a movie set in his frantic search for air. We queried Saran in San Quentin about Hall and his society. He wrote back that he remembered paying several visits to the headquarters, an alabaster temple near Griffith Park. The secretary there had a distinct foreign accent, unquote, he said. Hall's wife is German-born, and I had to ask her to unlock the bookcases for me to get the books I wanted to read in the library. I remember seeing Manly Hall himself there. Saran's dabbling with the occult society is, by itself, innocuous, but there is a certain irony in the fact that he was drinking from the same mystical fountain as Sam Yorty. For some 2 decades, the mayor had been a student of Hall, whom he regarded as his guru. Now, in the next section of Robert F. Kennedy, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian, there is some discussion here of a fellow named William Joseph Bryan, Jr. Now, William Joseph Bryan, Jr., according to some speculation engaged in by Turner and Christian, may have been the person who hypno-programmed Saran in the first place to be in the lobby, the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. Worth noting maybe in passing, too, that the Ambassador Hotel was owned by G. David Shine, who was one of Joseph McCarthy's assistants in the anti-communist witch hunt of the early 1950s. But this William Joseph Bryan Jr. is a subject of some lengthy discussion in The Assassination of Robert Kennedy.
All right, continuing on with the text. Our quest for Sirhan's programmer had been no more successful than the search for Amelia Earhart, until Dr. Herbert Spiegel gave us a lead. Anything mentioned in the presence of a subject under hypnosis is automatically etched into his mind, especially if it comes from the hypnotist, and it might flow out at any time. This brought us back to the notebooks containing Sirhan's, quote, automatic writing. Could he have scrawled something during a trance regression that the hypnotist had mentioned while programming him? There was a passage that stood out because it was, unlike the others, having nothing to do with horses, politics, money, or past acquaintances. It read, quote, God help me, please help me, salvo D, spelled D-I-D, salvo, die, S-salvo. The reference apparently was to Albert DeSalvo, the notorious Boston Strangler. That case had been cracked by the use of hypnotism, and the hypnotist was Dr. William Joseph Bryan, Jr. of Los Angeles. Bryan billed himself as, quote, probably the leading expert in the world on the use of hypnosis in criminal law, and often boasted about being called into baffling cases by law enforcement agencies, including the LAPD. The Boston Strangler case was his tour de force, and he was incessantly mentioning it. An imposing man with a wrestler's girth, Bryan claimed he was once drummer with a Tommy Dorsey band and a commercial airplane pilot. During the Korean War, he had put his hypnotic skills to use as, in his words, quote, chief of all medical survival training for the United States Air Force, which meant the brainwashing section, unquote. After the war, he reportedly became a CIA consultant in the agency's experimentation with mind control and behavior modification. Refused membership in all traditional medical societies, Bryan set up a medical and hypnotherapy practice on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, which he named the American Institute of Hypnosis. He used it as an aegis for wide-ranging symposiums on such topics as, quote, successful treatments of sexual disorders. Quote, I enjoy variety and I like to get to know people on a deep emotional level, he once told a magazine interviewer. One way of getting to know people is through intercourse. In 1969, the California Board of Medical Examiners found him guilty of unprofessional conduct for sexually molesting 4 women patients who submitted under hypnosis. Despite his advocacy of sexual freedom, Bryan was a Bible-quoting fundamentalist who belonged to a fire and brimstone sect called the Old Roman Catholic Church, which broke away from the Vatican over a century ago. Skipping down to the footnotes is, curiously, David W. Ferry, a prime suspect in New Orleans D.A. Jim Garrison's 1967 probe into the John Kennedy assassination, also belonged to this small sect. Ferry was found dead on February 22, 1967, shortly after being interrogated. Should mention that Ferry himself was also a pilot, as was apparently Bryan, or at least as Bryan claimed to be. Anyway, so Bryant was a member of the old Roman Catholic Church. Bryant claimed to be a descendant of the fiery orator William Jennings Bryant, who opposed the teaching of evolution and celebrated Scope's monkey trial. And he frequently was a guest preacher at fundamentalist churches in Southern California. Only hours after the Robert F. Kennedy shooting, and before Sirhan had been identified, Bryant appeared on the Los Angeles radio program of Ray Bream on KABC and offhandedly commented that the suspect probably acted under post-hypnotic suggestion. 2 years later, when Bryant appeared on another local radio program, Christian, that's John Christian, the author, one of the authors, Christian called in and asked him about his prescient analysis on the Bream show. At first, Bryant hedged, then declared that he had no professional opinion because he had not personally examined Sirhan. He quickly switched the subject to the Hollywood Strangler case, in which a Henry Bush was executed for murder. Quote, "He utilized self-hypnosis," Bryant asserted, noting that Bush once tried to burn off his own arm with cigarettes under self-hypnosis. Quote, "to get rid of the offending part, just like the old thing in the Bible, you know, if the left hand offend thee, cut it off." When we, meaning the authors again, asked Sirhan about the DeSalvo entry in his notebook, he replied that the name was entirely foreign to him. Was it possible that Bryant had placed Sirhan in a trance state and, given his propensity to boast constantly about the Boston Strangler case, repeated DeSalvo's name over and over, thus etching it into Sirhan's subconscious? In any case, Sirhan would not remember either the circumstances of his exposure to the name or who mentioned it. Since Bryant's ego seemed boundless, it was possible that an interview with him would produce the unexpected. It did. On June 18, 1974, Betsy Langman, a disarmingly attractive New York writer with whom we had been comparing notes, talked to Bryant in his Sunset Strip office suite on the pretext of doing a general article on hypnosis.